At 9, you're hardly a colt, are you?
No, ma'am, said Ed firmly. I'm a grown horse, and I don't want my mind or my morals improved.
This week on Selected Shorts, the famous Mr. Ed, and home is where the books are.
Do you realize Thomas Wolfe was wrong? Wolfe, the great literary beast, wrong? The title of one of his books, You Can't Go Home Again, he guessed. That's it. He was wrong. This is home. Your friends are still here.
I'm John Lithgow, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. Selected Shorts celebrates the way fiction can reveal things about all aspects of life. But on this show, we look comically and seriously at readers and writers. Most Americans are familiar with Mr. Ed, the talking horse from the popular 1960s sitcom. But Ed actually got his start in stories by the American author Walter R. Brooks, who also wrote the Freddy the Pig stories, as well as those about Mr. Ed and his long-suffering owner, Wilbur Pope. These tall tales, first published in the 1930s and 1940s, poke fun at suburban life. In the one we'll hear, read by Broadway star and Selected Shorts regular Tony Roberts, Ed learns to read with hilarious consequences. Here's Ed Has His Mind Improved.
I suppose it's kind of silly of me to keep on telling people about Wilbur Pope's talking horse. People are awful skeptical. Prove it, they say, prove it. Well, I can't prove it. Neither can Mr. Pope prove it, because the darn horse won't cooperate. He'll talk all right when he's alone with Mr. Pope, but get him out in company where you want him to show what he can do, and he shuts up like a clam. I've told everybody you can talk, Ed, said Mr. Pope, and I do think you might back me up. All our neighbors here around Mount Kisco are beginning to whisper behind their hands when I come into a room, and I've lost 2 of my best accounts because they say they can't leave their advertising in the hands of a man who chats with animals. I appeal to your better nature, Ed, he said. But Ed just laughed. Yeah, he said. Who told you I had one? So Mr. Pope had to go around and tell everybody that he had just been kidding and that Ed couldn't talk at all. But they still act funny to him in Mount Kisco. Well, I don't live in Mount Kisco, and I'm not an advertising man, and so I don't see why I can't tell the truth about things. And particularly about what happened when Ed learned to read, because there's a lesson in it for us. Well, Mr. Pope's house was always overrun on Saturdays and Sundays with a noisy crowd of Mrs. Pope's friends. At least I suppose you'd call them friends, for most of them were young men who were trying to persuade Mrs. Pope to run away from Mr. Pope. And marry them or something. It really wasn't any fun for Mr. Pope. It wasn't good for him either. He was getting a terrible inferiority complex, for all of Mrs. Pope's suitors treated him as if he were a sort of oaf. So he bought this horse, Ed, and spent most of his weekends riding. Ed had things the other way around. To him, Mrs. Pope was the oaf and Mr. Pope the jewel. And he didn't hesitate to say so. He was pretty outspoken, even for a horse. Mr. Pope said, Oh, tut, tut, and so on. I can't have you saying things about Carlotta, Ed. But he liked it. It built him up. He and Ed ambled over the countryside, stopping at wayside taverns for beer and lolling and arguing about life under roadside trees. Well, one day they were sitting around like this, and Mr. Pope was reading the Sunday paper. And every now and then he would read out an item to Ed, and they'd argue about it. But by and by, Ed said, I wish you'd lay off this political and business stuff. Haven't you got any good murders? Murders don't improve your mind, Ed, said Mr. Pope reprovingly. Neither do the columnists, said Ed. I'd like to pick my own news for a change. Well, said Mr. Pope, suppose I teach you to read. So after a while, they rode home, and Mr. Pope sneaked into the house the back way and got a bottle and an old primer from the attic and took them out to the barn. The first lesson wasn't very successful from a cultural point of view because the primer was one of those that starts with A stands for aardvark. What the hell is an aardvark? Said Ed. Why not teach me words I know, like A stands for ale. What's this next letter? Mr. Pope said it was B. Oh, that's an easy one, said Ed. B stands for beer. And what's this? C, said Mr. Pope. C stands for scotch. Said Ed. No, 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 Ed, said Mr. Pope. C stands for, cognac. Well, this didn't make sense to Ed, and Mr. Pope tried to explain, and they got into an argument that lasted until it was so dark that they couldn't see the letters anymore. The bottle was empty, too. Ed was persistent, and he had Mr. Pope nail the primer up over the manger, and in a week he could read, "The cat chases the rat as well as you or I can." Then Mr. Pope brought out an old school reader, and Ed went to work on that. But after he'd got through the third selection, he struck. "This stuff is too darn noble, Wilbur," he said. "I can get all the edification I need out of your conversation. Bring me something a little low." So Mr. Pope got copies of a few of the more ribald magazines, and as a slight corrective to these, he brought out the Three Musketeers. Ed simply ate them up. In the manger, Mr. Pope had rigged up a reading light, which was small enough so that Mrs. Pope couldn't see it from the house, and the horse read far into the night. He got very clever at turning the pages with his nose, and for the first few months he would hardly stop reading long enough to speak to Mr. Pope except to demand more books. But before long he had read all the adventure stories and even some of the more serious novels in the house. Mr. Pope wouldn't get him any more magazines with jokes or risque stories in them because twice Ed had got to roaring with laughter in the middle of the night, and Mrs. Pope had sent Mr. Pope out to the barn to see if it was tramps. So then Mr. Pope got Ed a card at the public library. So two or three nights a week, they would ride over to the library and get a couple of books. Of course, Mr. Pope had to go in and pick them out, and Ed didn't always like his selections. "That's all right, Ed," said Mr. Pope, "but you can't read detective and adventure stories all the time. Some of your reading ought to be to improve your mind." "Listen, Wilbur," said Ed, "I'm a horse." "What good is an improved mind in a stable?" "Get me a good Western to read tonight, will you?" Well, along in the early fall, Mr. Pope had to go to Detroit to present a new radio plan to one of his accounts. He got some library books and some detective story magazines for Ed, and he hired Joe, the handyman, to take care of the horse while he was away. And the first thing Joe did was to find Ed's library and tell Mrs. Pope about it. "Books in the barn?" said Mrs. Pope, and she went out to look them over. "Good heavens, what trash," she said. "Throw those magazines out at once, Joe. And these books seem to be some Mr. Pope got from the library. You'd better take them back." So Joe took them back. Well, Ed stuck it out without literature for 2 days. On the third evening, as soon as it got dark, he slipped his halter and, by cutting across lots and down back roads, reached the library unobserved just before closing time. He peeked in a window. Nobody was there but Miss Sigsby, the librarian. Ed pushed the front door open with his nose and clumped up to the desk. "Excuse me, ma'am," he said. "Have you got anything by Edgar Wallace?" Miss Sigsby gave a kind of faded squeal and went right over backwards. Chair and all. "Sorry I startled you, ma'am," said Ed. "If you got a slug of whiskey handy, it would make you feel better. I just wanted a book." Well, Miss Sigsby was an old-fashioned blue-ribbon teetotaler, and Ed's suggestion brought her round quicker than a drink would have. She was up and back in her chair before you could say John Galsworthy. "How dare you," she said. "How dare you leave this library at once?"
"I don't get it, ma'am," said Ed, backing away from her. "I just wanted a book."
"A horse," she said, staring at him, and she shuddered. Then she stiffened again. "Horse or no horse," she said, "you dare to come in here and offer me a drink of liquor?"
"Oh, that," said Ed. "I didn't offer you a drink. I don't use the stuff myself. But skip it. Can I get a book out on Wilbur Pope's card?"
"Mr. Pope," said Miss Sigsby. "You're Mr. Pope's horse. I remember there was some gossip about his pretending he had a talking horse. People thought he was joking. But then it wasn't a joke."
"No, ma'am," said Ed. "Now, about that book."
"Of course we can let you have a book," said Miss Sigsby.
"But the books Mr. Pope has been selecting for you, dear me, you won't mind if I select something suitable for you?"
"Well, ma'am," said Ed, "if you got any Edgar Wallace..."
"Let me see," said Miss Sigsby. "How old are you?"
Ed said he was rising 9.
9, said Miss Sigsby, going over to a shelf. "Now, here is just the thing for you. Exciting and at the same time a high moral tone. Have you read any of the Rollo books?"
"Nah," said Ed disgustedly.
"See here, young man," said Miss Sigsby sternly. Then she stopped and said, "Gracious, I can't call you young man, can I? What should it be, young colt?" "But at 9, you're hardly a colt, are you?"
"No, ma'am," said Ed firmly. "I'm a grown horse, and I don't want my mind or my morals improved." "Now, can I have an Edgar Wallace?"
"Why, of course," said Miss Sigsby. "We can't force you to improve yourself." And she got an Edgar Wallace, and Ed thanked her and trotted off with it in his mouth.
Well, Mr. Pope was in Detroit 10 days, and Ed went over to the library every night, and he and Miss Sigsby got quite friendly. The library was badly in need of funds, and so far all money-raising schemes had failed. Miss Sigsby didn't have much sense about such things, but she did know that a horse that could read would draw a crowd. So she put it up to Ed. Would he give a public reading? Well, it was against Ed's principles to do such a thing, but he couldn't help being flattered.
"Gosh, ma'am," he said, "it's nice of you to ask me, but I really couldn't."
"Nonsense," said Miss Sigsby. "Of course you could. The library has done a good deal for you, and isn't it rather selfish of you to refuse to do a small thing for the library?"
"Well," said Ed slowly, "now you put it that way, I suppose it is." "Well," he said, "I'll do it."
The next day, Mr. Pope got home, and he was pretty sore when Ed told him, "I suppose you know what it means. Thousands of curiosity seekers tramping over the lawn and eating peanuts and staring at you, and news photographers hiding in the oat bin. Never a moment to yourself anymore.
No cross, no crown, Wilbur. Said Ed. I expect it's the penalty of fame. And don't forget, there'll be Hollywood scouts, too.
I am not forgetting it, said Mr. Pope. But what good would it be if I signed up a Hollywood contract for you? You wouldn't go through with it and let me make some money. You'd just refuse to talk again.
Probably I would, said Ed. But I don't see why I can't have a little fun when it comes my way. And anyway, he said, I promised Miss Sigsby.
Mr. Pope was pretty upset. The good times he and Ed had had together would come to an end once the horse was a celebrity. And Carlotta would be furious at the notoriety. He walked down to the library that night to plead with Miss Sigsby, but it wasn't any good. Anyway, I couldn't stop it now if I wanted to, she said. I've taken the matter up with the trustees. I hadn't anticipated that they would be so skeptical. Frankly, Mr. Pope, my position and even my reputation are at stake. Mrs. Dilway and Dr. Polder are the only trustees in town. Mrs. Dilway has agreed always to double any amount we take in through our little entertainments. Of course, as there is usually a deficit, but as I was saying, I have always considered her and Dr. Polder very good friends of mine, but when I told them, dear me, it was a very stormy session. I insisted, however, and finally they did agree to give me a chance to prove my assertion. We have arranged to meet quite informally tomorrow evening in my garden. Now that you're back, Mr. Pope, you will, of course, come over with Ed. You see my position, I am sure. If he doesn't read for them at this little dress rehearsal, Mr. Pope saw all right. So the next evening, he rode Ed over. Mrs. Dilway was a large, imposing presence. She did not believe that horses could talk, as was manifest in the indignant heave of her massive bosom as she gazed on Ed. The Reverend Dr. Polder didn't believe it either. You see how people really feel toward a talking horse, Ed? Said Mr. Pope as they paused before crossing the lawn toward the three. And here's another thing, he said. When the Hollywood producers begin to bid for you, I'm going to sign up with the highest bidder. I'm going to sign a bill of sale. Think that over.
What? Said Ed. Hey, Wilbur, you can't do that.
You've made your bed, Ed, said Mr. Pope.
Come on.
No, but have a heart, Wilb, Ed protested. I'm in a spot. If I let Miss Sigsby down now, she'll lose her job.
You should have thought of that before, said Mr. Pope, pulling him forward.
Good evening, Miss Sigsby.
Miss Sigsby got up and presented Ed and Mr. Pope to the trustees. They bowed coldly to Mr. Pope, and Dr. Polder gave Ed a timid nod. But Mrs. Dilway flipped open a lorgnette and gave the horse her celebrated basilisk once over. Ed fidgeted for a second, and then he threw up his head.
You don't need that thing, lady, he said. I'll tell you what I am. I'm a horse.
Mrs. Dilway gave a strong shudder. Don't be impudent, she said. Then she turned and caught Dr. Polder by the wrist. He had been saying, oh, dear me, and wringing his hands. Be quiet, Dr. Polder, she said.
No, said Dr. Polder, trying to jerk away. This is witchcraft, sorcery. I cannot countenance such an exhibition. My bishop,
nonsense, said Mrs. Dilway. It's merely ventriloquism. We shall expose it. So, after a minute, Dr. Polder calmed down, though he continued to tremble, and Miss Sigsby took a magazine and had Mrs. Dilway open it at random and then held it up for Ed to read, while Mr. Pope sat down next to Mrs. Dilway. Ed glanced at the page and shook his head.
No, he said. I can't do it.
Why, Ed? Said Miss Sigsby. "It's hard on you, ma'am," said Ed, "but I got to consider my own future. Come on, Wilbur. Let's get out of here."
Mrs. Dilway's lorgnette came up again, and she gave a satisfied smile. "You see, Doctor," she said, "simply ventriloquism. Naturally, if this Mr. Pope can't see the page, the horse can't read it."
"Oh, is that so?" Ed burst out. And Miss Sigsby said,
"But Mrs. Dilway, the horse really can read. I've heard him." "I am sorry to see you persist in this attempt to hoax us, Miss Sigsby," said Mrs. Dilway. "The outcome can only be unfortunate for you. As for you, Mr. Pope, it seems to me that you are carrying a silly joke dangerously far."
"Well, Ed," said Mr. Pope resignedly, "I take back what I said about selling you. You better do your stuff. We're going to get a lot of unpleasant publicity out of this anyway of the goods." "Leave it to me, boss," said Ed under his breath. "There won't be any public reading, and these goofs won't talk either." Then he said to Miss Sigsby, "What do you want me to read?" So Miss Sigsby held the page up, and Ed began. "The waters of the lake," he read, "had changed from lead to silver and from silver to rose."
"Good gracious," said Mrs. Dilway. "He really is reading. Why, this... Miss Sigsby, I am afraid we owe you an apology. Go on, Ed.
So Ed went on. "The first flush of surprise reddened the naked limbs of the slender..."
Ed!
interrupted Miss Sigsby, blushing.
"It's sunrise, not surprise."
"Sorry," said Ed. "This is kind of fine print for a horse." He winked at Mr. Pope and continued.
Well, he read a paragraph or two more, and gradually the outraged expression faded from Mrs. Dilway's face. Then Ed read.
"As Gregory stepped out of the canoe, the girl ran to him. He seized her and kicked her passionately on the mouth, then drew back and booted her in the eyes."
"Kissed, Ed," said Miss Sigsby, "and looked."
"Oh," said Ed, and continued. "Darling," she cried, "if Father finds you here..." "I have my own ways of knowing about your father," he said. "He will not find me here, for he has found a better thing elsewhere today." The words were obscene, and as she nestled in his embrace,
"Really, Ed," said Mr. Pope, and Miss Sigsby said crossly, "the word is obscure, not obscene."
"I'm sorry," said Ed. "I guess it's the company. I mean, naturally, I'm a little nervous. Gregory," she said. "Now, damn you..." "Oh, hey, wait a minute," said Ed, interrupting himself. "I guess that's, how can you?" Mrs. Dilway had got to her feet.
"Come, Dr. Polder, we have had quite enough of this obscene exhibition. Please understand, Miss Sigsby, that from today I withdraw all support from the library."
"Hey, just a minute," said Ed.
He trotted around in front of the departing pair.
"There's something you ought to know, ma'am," he said, "before you pull anything like that. I'm giving a reading tonight down at the Elks Hall. It'll be announced that it's for the benefit of the library. And, of course, you'll have to stick to your agreement and match what we take in."
"You're giving no such disgraceful performance for any library I am connected with," said Mrs. Dilway angrily.
"How are you going to stop it?" asked Ed. And as Mrs. Dilway glared, he said, "Now, ma'am, I don't want to be mean, but we got to raise money. If you want to hand Miss Sigsby a check for double what me and Wilbur estimate tonight's gate at, well, we'll call the reading off." Well, Mrs. Dilway was practically speechless.
This is extortion," she said.
"Yes, ma'am," said Ed. "Shall we say 1,500?
No, shouted Mrs. Dilway, but Dr. Polder drew her aside and after a few minutes came back to say that she agreed. Oh, dear, said Miss Sigsby when they had gone. It is wonderful about the money, of course, but I'm afraid my position is gone.
Pooh, said Ed. They won't either of them dare say a word about this.
No, said Mr. Pope. They can hardly go around complaining that they were insulted by a horse. Vulgar, but effective. That's Ed.
Yeah, said Ed. And the same thing could be said of Shakespeare.
Dear me, said Mrs. Sigsby. I never thought of it that way. But it's true.
Just the same, said Ed. That 1,500 smackers will buy a lot of Edgar Wallace. Oh, wait a minute, lady. I know. But part of it you're going to get Edgar Wallace with, aren't you? If you want to make the world better, you got to stop trying to improve people's minds and start improving their dispositions. Speaking of which, Wilbur, how about a can of beer? Huh? Oh, excuse me, ma'am, for mentioning it.
Not at all, said Mrs. Sigsby archly. After all, Shakespeare also drank beer. I wonder...
She hesitated, and Ed winked slowly at Mr. Pope.
After all, he said, we can't any of us never say anything about this evening in public, can we? So it might as well be a good one, Wilbur. Let's creep over to Horley's and bring back half a case.
Tony Roberts, giving it to us straight from the horse's mouth, in Walter Brooks, Ed Has His Mind Improved. After a brief break, an unexpected tale from Ray Bradbury. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm John Lithgow. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. I have a fabulous personal history with Selected Shorts myself. I think I've read about 5 or 6 stories over the years, but also the nice thing is that about 3/4 of the readers are very good friends of mine from the New York acting community. When we read these stories, we try to bring them to life almost as if they were one-act plays. Sometimes there's not even a narrator. It's all dialogue, or the narrator himself is the principal character in the story. It's a matter of getting into the mind of the writer and almost taking over his role to present the story to an audience instead of to a reader. The late Ray Bradbury is best known for his fantasy work, such as the novels Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles, and the story The Veldt, which we featured on Selected Shorts. But Exchange is a gentle, realistic tale of a late-night encounter between an overworked librarian and a lonely soldier. It's read by a loyal friend of Selected Shorts, the actress Rochelle Oliver.
There were too many cards in the file, too many books on the shelves, too many children laughing in the children's room, too many newspapers to fold and stash on the racks. All in all, too much. Miss Adams pushed her gray hair back over her lined brow, adjusted her gold-rimmed pince-nez, and rang the small silver bell on the library desk, at the same time switching off and on all the lights. The exodus of adults and children was exhausting. Miss Ingram, the assistant librarian, had gone home early because her father was sick, so it left the burden of stamping, filing, and checking books squarely on Miss Adams' shoulders. Finally, the last book was stamped, the last child fed through the great brass doors, the doors locked, and with immense weariness, Miss Adams moved back up through a silence of 40 years of books and being keeper of the books, stood for a long moment by the main desk. She laid her glasses down on the green blotter and pressed the bridge of her small bone nose between thumb and forefinger and held it, eyes shut. What a racket. Children who finger-painted or cartooned frontispieces or rattled their roller skates. High school students arriving with laughters, departing with mindless songs. Taking up her rubber stamp, she probed the files, weeding out errors, her fingers whispering between Dante and Darwin. A moment later, she heard the rapping on the front door glass and saw a man's shadow outside wanting in. She shook her head. The figure pleaded silently, making gestures. Sighing, Miss Adams opened the door, saw a young man in uniform, and said, "It's late. We're closed." She glanced at his insignia and added, "Captain." Hold on, said the captain. Remember me? And repeated it as she hesitated. Remember? She studied his face, trying to bring light out of shadow. Yes, I think I do, she said at last. You once borrowed books here. Right. Many years ago, she added. Now I almost have you placed. As he stood waiting, she tried to see him in those other years, but his younger face did not come clear or a name with it, and his hand reached out now to take hers. May I come in? Well, she hesitated, yes. She led the way up the steps into the immense twilight of books. The young officer looked around and let his breath out slowly, then reached to take a book and hold it to his nose, inhaling, then almost laughing. Don't mind me, Miss Adams. You ever smell new books? Binding, pages, print, like fresh bread when you're hungry. He glanced around. I'm hungry now, but I don't even know what for. There was a moment of silence, so she asked him how long he might stay. Just a few hours. I'm on the train from New York to L.A., so I came up from Chicago to see old places, old friends. His eyes were troubled, and he fretted his cap, turning it in his long, slender fingers. She said gently, "Is anything wrong? Anything I can help you with?" He glanced out the window at the dark town with just a few lights in the windows of the small houses across the way. "I was surprised," he said. "By what?" "Well, I don't know what I expected." "Pretty damn dumb," he said, looking from her to the windows, "to expect that when I went away, everyone froze in place, waiting for me to come home. That when I stepped off the train, all my old pals would unfreeze, run down, meet me at the station. Silly." "No," she said, more easily now. "I think we all imagined that. I visited Paris as a young girl, went back to France when I was 40, and was outraged that no one had waited. Buildings had vanished, and all the hotel staff where I had once lived had died, retired, or traveled." He nodded at this, but could not seem to go on. "Did anyone know you were coming?" she asked. "Well, I wrote a few, but no answers. I figured, hell, they're busy, but they'll be there." They weren't. She felt the next words come off her lips and was faintly surprised. "I'm still here," she said. "You are," he said with a quick smile, and I can't tell you how glad I am. He was gazing at her now with such intensity that she had to look away. You know, she said, I must confess you look familiar, but I don't quite fit your face with the boy who came here 20 years ago. And as for what he looked like, that other one, me, well, he brought out a smallish wallet which held a dozen pictures and handed over a photograph of a boy, perhaps 12 years old, with an impish smile and wild blonde hair, looking as if he might catapult out of the frame. Ah, yes, Miss Adams adjusted her pince-nez and closed her eyes to remember that one. Spaulding. William Henry Spaulding? He nodded and peered at the picture in her hands anxiously. Was I a lot of trouble? Yes, she nodded and held the picture closer and glanced up at him. A fiend. She handed the picture back, but I loved you. Did you? He said and smiled more broadly. In spite of you, yes. He waited a moment and then said, Do you still love me? She looked to left and right as if the dark stacks held the answer. It's a little early to know, isn't it? Forgive. No, no, a good question. Time will tell. Let's not stand like your frozen friends who didn't move. Come along. I've just had some late night coffee. There may be some left. Give me your cap, take off that coat, the file index is there. Go look up your old library cards for the hell of the heck of it. Are they still there in a maze? Librarians save everything. You never know who's coming in on the next train. Go. When she came back with the coffee, he stood staring down into the index file like a bird fixing its gaze on a half-empty nest. He handed her one of the old purple-stamped cards. My God, he said, I took out a lot of books. 10 at a time. I said no, but you took them and, she added, read them here. She put his cup on top of the file and waited while he drew out canceled card after card and laughed quietly. I can't believe I must not have lived anywhere else but here. May I take this with me to sit? He showed the card. She nodded. Can you show me around? I mean, maybe I've forgotten something. She shook her head and took his elbow. I doubt that. Come on. Over here, of course, is the adult section. I begged you to let me cross over when I was 13. You're not ready, you said, but I let you cross over anyway. You did, and much thanks. Another thought came to him as he looked down at her. You used to be taller than me, he said. She looked up at him, amused. I've noticed that happens quite often in my life, but I can still do this. Before he could move, she grabbed his chin in her thumb and forefinger and held tight. His eyes rolled. He said, I remember when I was really bad, you'd hold on and put your face down close and scowl. The scowl did it. After 10 seconds of your holding my chin very tight, I behaved for days. She nodded, released his chin. He rubbed it, and as they moved on, he ducked his head, not looking at her. Forget. I hope you won't be upset, but when I was a boy, I used to look up and see you behind your desk, so near, but far away. And how can I say this? I used to think that you were Mrs. God, and that the library was a whole world, and that no matter what part of the world or what people or thing I wanted to see and read, you'd find it and give it to me. He stopped, his face coloring. You did, too. You had the world ready for me every time I asked. There was always a place I hadn't seen, a country I hadn't visited, where you took me. I've never forgotten. She looked around, slowly, at the thousands of books. She felt her heart move quietly. Did you really call me what you just said? Mrs. God? Oh, yes, often, always. Come along, she said at last. They walked around the rooms together and then downstairs to the newspaper files, and coming back up, he suddenly leaned against the banister, holding tight. "Miss Adams," he said. "What is it, Captain?" He exhaled. "I'm scared. I don't want to leave. I'm afraid." Her hand, all by itself, took his arm, and she finally said, there in the shadows, "Sometimes I'm afraid, too. What frightens you?" "I don't want to go away without saying goodbye. If I never return, I want to see all my friends, shake hands, slap them on the back, I don't know, make jokes." He stopped and waited, then went on, "But I walk around town and nobody knows me. Everyone's gone." The pendulum on the wall clock slid back and forth, shining with the merest of sounds. Hardly knowing where she was going, Miss Adams took his arm and guided him up the last steps away from the marble vaults below to a final brightly decorated room where he glanced around and shook his head. "There's no one here either. Do you believe that? Well, where are they? Do any of my old pals ever come visit, borrow books, bring them back late?" "Not often," she said, "but listen. Do you realize Thomas Wolfe was wrong? Wolf, the great literary beast, wrong? The title of one of his books, 'You Can't Go Home Again,' he guessed. That's it. He was wrong. This is home. Your friends are still here. This was your summer place. Yes, myths, legends, mummies, Aztec kings, wicked sisters who spat toads, where I really lived, but I don't see my people. Well..." And before he could speak, she switched on a green-shaded lamp that shed a private light on a small table. "Isn't this nice?" she said. "Most libraries today, much, much too light. There should be shadows, don't you think? Some mystery, yes? So that late nights the beasts can prowl out of the stacks and crouch by this jungle light to turn the pages with their breath. Am I crazy?" "Not that I noticed." "Good, sit. Now that I know who you are, it all comes back." "It couldn't possibly..." "No, you'll see." She vanished into the stacks and came out with 10 books that she placed upright, their pages a trifle spread so they could stand and he could read the titles. "The summer of 1930, when you were, what, 10? You read all of these in 1 week. Oz, Dorothy, the Wizard, oh, yes." She placed still others nearby. "Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass. A month later, you reborrowed both. But I said, 'You've already read them.' But you said, 'Not enough so I can speak. I want to be able to tell them out loud.'" "My God," he said quietly. "Did I say that?" "You did. Here's more you read a dozen times. Greek myths, Roman, Egyptian, Norse myths, Chinese. You were ravenous. King Tut arrived from the tomb when I was 3. His picture in the rotogravure started me. What else have you there? Tarzan of the Apes. You borrowed it 3 dozen times. John Carter, Warlord of Mars, 4 dozen. My God, dear lady, how come you remember all this? You never left. Summertimes you were here when I unlocked the doors. You went home for lunch, but sometimes brought sandwiches and sat out by the stone lion at noon. Your father pulled you home by your ear some nights when you stayed late. How could I forget a boy like that? But still, you never played. Never ran out in baseball weather or football. I imagine why." He glanced toward the front door. "They were waiting for me. They. You know, the ones who never borrowed books, never read. They, them, those." She looked and remembered. "Ah, yes. The bullies. Why did they chase you?" "Because they knew I loved books and didn't much care for them. It's a wonder you survived. I used to watch you getting, reading hunchbacked late afternoons. You looked so lonely." "No, I had these, company. Here's more." She put down Ivanhoe, Robin Hood, and Treasure Island. "Oh," he said, "and dear and strange Mr. Poe, how I loved his Red Death. You took it so often I told you to keep it on permanent loan unless someone else asked. Someone did 6 months later, and when you brought it in, I could see it was a terrible blow. A few days later, I let you have Poe for another year. I don't recall. Did you ever... Oh, it's out in California. Shall I... No. No. Please. Well, here are your books. Let me bring others. She came out, not carrying many books, but one at a time, as if each one were indeed special. She began to make a circle inside the other Stonehenge circle, and as she placed the books in lonely splendor, he said their names, and then the names of the authors who had written them, and then the names of those who had sat across from him so many years ago and read the books quietly, or sometimes whispered the finest parts out loud so beautifully that no one said quiet or silence or even shh. She placed the first book, and there was a wild field of broom and a wind blowing a young woman across that field as it began to snow, and someone far away called Kathy, and as the snows fell, he saw a girl he had walked to school in the sixth grade, seated across the table, her eyes fixed to the wind-blown field and the snow and the lost woman in another time of winter. A second book was set in place, and a black and beauteous horse raced across a summer field of green, and on that horse was another girl who hid behind the book and dared to pass him notes when he was 12. And then there was the far ghost with a snow maiden face whose hair was a long golden harp played by the summer airs, she who was always sailing to Byzantium where emperors were drowsed by golden birds that sang in clockwork cages at sunset and dawn. She who always skirted the outer rim of school and went to swim in the deep lake 10,000 afternoons ago and never came out, so was never found. But now, suddenly, she made landfall here in the green-shaded light and opened Yates to at last sail home from Byzantium. And on her right, John Huff, whose name came clearer than the rest, who claimed to have climbed every tree in town and fallen from none, who had raced through watermelon patches, treading melons, never touching earth, to knock down rainfalls of chestnuts with one blow, who yodeled at your sun-up window and wrote the same Mark Twain book report in four different grades. Before the teachers caught on, at which he said, vanishing, "Just call me Huck." And to his right, the pale son of the town hotel owner, who looked as if he had gone sleepless forever, who swore every empty house was haunted and took you there to prove it with a juicy tongue, compressed nose, and throat garglings that sounded the long October demise, the terrible and unutterable fall of the house of Usher. And next to him was yet another girl, and next to her, and just beyond, Miss Adams placed a final book, and he recalled the fair creature long ago, when such things were left unsaid, glancing up at him one day when he was an unknowing 12 and she was a wise 13, to quietly say, "I am beauty, and you, are you the beast?" Now, late in time, he wanted to answer that small and wondrous ghost. "No, he hides in the stacks, and when the clock strikes three, will prowl forth to drink." And it was finished. All the books were placed, the outer ring of his selves, and the inner ring of remembered faces, deathless with summer and autumn names. He sat for a long moment and then another long moment and then one by one reached for and took all of the books that had been his and still were and opened them and read and shut them and took another until he reached the end of the outer circle and then went to touch and turn and find the raft on the river, the field of broom where the storms lived and the pasture with a black and beauteous horse and its lovely rider. Behind him, he heard the lady librarian quietly back away to leave him with words. A long while later, he sat back, rubbed his eyes, and looked around at the fortress, the encirclement, the Roman encampment of books, and nodded, his eyes wet. Yes. He heard her move behind him. Yes, what? What you said? Thomas Wolfe? The title of that book of his? Wrong. Everything's here. Nothing's changed. Nothing will as long as I can help it, she said. Don't ever go away. I won't, if you'll come back more often. Just then, from below the town, not so very far off, a train whistle blew. She said, is that yours? No, but the one soon after, he said, and got up and moved around the small monuments that stood very tall, and one by one shut the covers, his lips moving to sound the old titles and the old dear names. Do we have to put them back on the shelves? He said. She looked at him and at the double circle and after a long moment said, tomorrow will do. Why? Maybe, he said. During the night, because of the color of those lamps, green, the jungle, maybe those creatures you mentioned will come out and turn the pages with their breath, and maybe, what else? Maybe my friends who've hidden the stacks all these years will come out, too. They're already here, she said quietly. Yes, he nodded. They are. And still he could not move. She backed off across the room without making any sound, and when she reached her desk, she called back the last call of the night. Closing time! Closing time, children! And turned the lights quickly off, and then on, and then halfway between, a library twilight. He moved from the table with the double circle of books and came to her and said, I can go now. Yes, she said, William Henry Spaulding, you can. They walked together as she turned out the lights one by one. She helped him into his coat, and then, hardly thinking to do so, he took her hand and kissed her fingers. It was so abrupt, she almost laughed. But then she said, remember what Edith Wharton said when Henry James did what you just did. What? The flavor starts at the elbow. They broke into laughter together, and he turned and went down the marble steps toward the stained glass entry. At the bottom of the stairs, he looked up at her and said, tonight, when you're going to sleep, remember what I called you when I was 12 and say it out loud. I don't remember, she said. Yes, you do. Below the town, a train whistle blew again. He opened the front door, stepped out, and he was gone. Her hand on the last light switch, looking in at the double circle of books on the far table, she thought, what was it he called me? Oh, yes, she said a moment later, and switched off the light.
That was Rochelle Oliver performing Ray Bradbury's Exchange. If there was ever a man who understood the pull of a good book, it was our late host and friend, Isaiah Sheffer. Here he is, reading a brief but powerful piece by the influential writer Jorge Luis Borges. Borges' prose always seems to leap right off the page. Here's the voice of Isaiah, conjuring up dream tigers.
In my childhood, I was a fervent worshipper of the tiger. Not the jaguar, that spotted tiger that inhabits the floating islands of water hyacinths along the Paraná and the tangled wilderness of the Amazon, but the true tiger, the striped Asian breed that can be faced only by men of war in a castle atop an elephant. I would stand for hours on end before one of the cages at the zoo. I would rank vast encyclopedias and natural history books by the splendor of their tigers. I still remember those pictures, I who cannot recall without error a woman's brow or smile. My childhood outgrown, the tigers and my passion for them faded, but they are still in my dreams. In that underground sea or chaos, they still endure. As I sleep, I am drawn into some dream or other, and suddenly I realize that it's a dream. At those moments, I often think, this is a dream, a pure diversion of my will. And since I have unlimited power, I am going to bring forth a tiger. Oh, incompetence. My dreams never seem to engender the creature I so hunger for. The tiger does not appear. But it is all dried up, or it's flimsy looking, or it has impure vagaries of shape, or an unacceptable size, or it's altogether too ephemeral, or it looks more like a dog or a bird than a tiger.
Isaiah Sheffer, Dreaming of Tigers, in Jorge Luis Borges' story, Dream Tigers. I'm John Lithgow. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, a classic chiller, The Monkey's Paw, and some magic words from Isabel Allende. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the best American short stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Perotta. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the short story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust's Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.